Hi folks, I'm Alan Watt and this is Carrying Through the Matrix on the 4th of August 2019. I hope you're all doing okay and getting by, because that's all we can do these days is just get by if we can. We're awfully lucky if we do get by, and because things are not great in the economy anyway really, and it's planned that way as always, because after all, since no one's on a gold standard anymore, money really is a magic act for those who control it at the top, because that's really what money is at the top. It runs the world, it controls the world, it controls every government, and it's so important for those. It's a tiny clique at the top really who manage the whole banking system across the planet. And I'm sure there's lots of books out there, you all know that, on the histories of banking. And I've talked many times too about the groups based in London who eventually became the Lord Alfred Milner Group and the Cecil Rhodes Society. And eventually we came out of them with the Round Tables and the Royal Institute for International Affairs - Council on Foreign Relations, who basically are planning everything for the planet, so it would seem. And they're not the top people at it, but they certainly are the people who manage the affairs of the world, the foreign offices, the foreign departments, the treaties. Parts of them manage the economies, basically. And they run the Federal Reserve Systems with the Trilateral Commission branch. And therefore, they run the whole world. They decide who's going to be popular, who's going to be famous, and who's going to get toppled at the top out of maybe into infamy from fame. And so on. That's how the world is. And they also take delights in boasting that they drafted up and planned the world to be broken into three parts, basically. The three unions, the European Union, an American Union, which would eventually broaden into the Americas and the Caribbean as well, into one system, and the European Union, and then the Far Eastern Pacific Rim region as well. So you've got this great plan they've had for a long, long time. And people will think, and I understand it perfectly well, what's wrong with that? There've been many debates too over many years. Well, wouldn't we get there eventually anyway? And maybe we would, maybe we wouldn't. But the whole plan here is to really, like the Marxian concept too. If things can happen along the way through time in a natural process, why not use your abilities to make it happen faster? So plan the problems, plan the solutions, etc. And eventually you can go up the ladder with the Hegelian dialectic and get the world where you want it to be. So if that included wars and world wars, you would use all of that, you see. And that is the system that's been used on the planet. But those at the top, and folk will say too, oh, you know, they might agree with that. It's like when you're young and you read Bertrand Russell, you'd think, that guy's got a lot of common sense in here in what he's saying. But it really isn't until you'd go into the cliques that they all belong to, and eugenic societies, and yeah, they need all your help to get things rammed through, just like the Bolsheviks needed the mob, as they call them, the people behind them, to overthrow the Tsar and take over the country. They always use the mob, and you end up getting something completely different at the end of it than what you imagined, because there's not you always think in them and us. That's how people think. And it never occurs to you, if you're fighting for them, you see, then you're now part of us. That's what you think. But them at the top don't see you as part of us. That's just it. And again, I've given many examples over the years of the ones who helped foment revolutions. And don't forget, we're still going through revolutions now. You don't need a massive bloodshed to go through revolution. Most of the revolutions we go through are fairly bloodless. They're cultural, they're sexual, they're into gender, they're into all kinds of things today. And these are parts of revolutions that were planned a long, long time ago. And you think you know that where it's all going, but the fact is, it's a long-term process. We're reaching the end of one phase of it, that's for sure. Within about 30 years or so, they'll have a... You wouldn't recognize the world in 30 years' time, or the cultures in it, or the types of new cultures that have been fomented and created for everybody to follow, because cultures are definitely planned and formulated and successfully put across on the public, who adapt into it rather easily without thinking. And it's not their fault. It's not their fault because they think they're free. If you're free, why would you be emulating behaviors of what we used to call decayed civilizations or defunct civilizations, where the ancient Rome and ancient Greece basically collapsed from within? They didn't really need the people invading from without. They couldn't. It was so bad at the end with their debaucheries and their partying and so on. They didn't even have enough children of an ability to take over, to grow up and take over and run the country. It was just so corrupt and yeah. So here we are again. And so if you want to bring down a society or a system that you've used, if you're something behind the scenes, say, and you're always using others to do what you want to do and where you want to get, you use them, you see. Once you've gotten to this position where they think they're the bosses, then you have to get rid of them gradually. Well, that's what happened to the British Empire, obviously. It's happened to the US too. And it's always a shock to those involved. Interesting enough, I mean, Rudyard Kipling was involved heavily, of course, naturally, with what he saw as the British system and the Raj system in India and British Empire, where they literally thought the sun would never set on the British Empire, as he said. They couldn't imagine it. They had never had so much wealth across the world. The people who were born into it on behalf of the officialdom of the empire. They had servants and all the rest of it. And a servant, really, as far as I'm concerned, is basically a paid slave, isn't it? They didn't like that term in Britain, so they called them serfs, basically. But they were definitely bought and sold with the land. But, as I say, when a ruling managerial class have served their purpose, give them 60, 70 years, maybe 100 at the maximum, and they'll die off rather quickly. Because just like every other defunct, as they call it, defunct and arrested civilization, you go backwards. You start drinking, you take drugs, you have a sexual immorality, you don't have children, just like ancient Romans, and so on, so on, so on, until you're overrun by the next phase. And the next phase, of course, of those who are going to manage the world are chosen by an elite again, a quiet elite at the back, to take over. And they have really a completely different mindset, most of them. They're brought into this new computerized industry. They're okay at what they do. It's all mathematics, basically. They get cocky and arrogant very quickly, very, very quickly, when the big money rolls in. And they get their lectures given to them, too, that they're the new rulers and they can rule billions of people's minds easily with algorithms, etc., which they can, by the way. And I'll touch on a little bit, just a tiny little bit of it tonight, because it is boring. I'm sure you've all read about it in various places. But the people who they bring in today, who are taking over, who are made the multimillionaires and multibillionaires very quickly, are still a managerial class on behalf of something above themselves, which they don't quite understand or believe is there. The greatest way to blind people is to make them think they're at the top, and they get terribly arrogant, and when they get too arrogant, in fact, and they won't take the little hints that'll trickle down to them, they're simply removed in different ways from the system. And getting back to Rudyard Kipling, he was part of the establishment. He was the big author of the day and a good speaker as well. For the British, I say, in India, he and many others in his own era, his class system, like you find, for instance, you had the later H.G. Wells. This was a whole class who saw the world as a place to be ruled, a place to be shaped, and they were taught, certainly by their owners at the top, the very, very top, that the culture, everything would be changed. And H.G. Wells was very, very aware of this, and he was all for it, he thought, at the time. But their shocks came. Their shocks came to all of them, even Kipling too, when that the torch was handed over to America to take over. Britain was exhausted with all the wars. The taxpayers paid for it all, one way or another. Everything you bought had taxes on it like crazy. They were exhausted after right up through World War One. And so the torch was handed, and it was planned to be handed before even World War started, to the US, a much, much bigger population coming in, all the time getting bigger and bigger and bigger. It had a workforce from across the planet flooding in there. It had massive land space, great mineral rights and ores and all the rest of it. And it could be exploited and up and running very, very quickly, which, of course, it was. There's a lot of factory towns, a lot of factory. They'd almost be called factory cities. Some of them were so big at one time. It was a massive machine. That's how people could see it, as a massive machine of production. And Britain couldn't stand up to it at all. As I say, Britain was exhausted because the public themselves are cannon fodder, naturally, for those who own an empire. And those who own an empire don't even see the people that they use as even being off the same stock, you might say, of themselves. They see themselves as almost a completely different race to themselves. And Britain certainly had that incredibly arrogant system installed there. Anyway, for those, as I say, that help to push on to the next step and the next. They are in shock. They are in shock when it's handed off to someone else because they think they're going to be in on it. Some of the big players have said that many of those who help us, Julian Huxley, for instance, I hate saying this stuff because there's somebody grabs it all the time and uses it as his own, a rather big one all the time. But anyway, Julian Huxley said that. He said that many will serve us and work for us to eliminate the old, he's talking about the system. And he said, and they'll expect to come, but we'll bring him into the new system. It was almost verbatim to George Bernard Shaw. But they both said, they'll be shocked to find out after all their lifelong work and help that they don't have the right stuff, you might say, to get through themselves and to go into the next phase. They'll be eliminated as well. So that's how the system is. I've said it before, that the elites see, and there is an elite. There definitely is an elite. Of course there is an elite. And they decide what the future is going to be. They don't sit and bury themselves in books to find out what to do. They have lots and lots, millions of academia now, those in academia, doing all that kind of work for them. They have hundreds, and maybe if not thousands today, of think tanks across the world, which they have working on all kinds of the big agendas, problems, and how to overcome them, how to get round laws, and all that kind of stuff, perpetually. So when they meet together, they want all the facts presented to them by the experts. And that's how things proceed. The people at the top are very, very calm. Very calm. They don't sit and fret about things or worry about things. They leave the worrying to those who are employed by them. That's the beauty of being incredibly, not just incredibly, incredibly wealthy, but a member of the upper echelons and elites. I have to laugh and cry to an extent too at the misery that will come when once again you read that they're into the next phase, of course, of top of this new chapter we're in, of eliminating any voices out there on internet or whatever that they don't like. And they have to have some kind of excuse for doing so, be it fake news, be it whatever. But now they're also going, oh, and there's all kinds of it, or they're racist, or you name it, blah, blah, blah. Any excuse will do to eliminate anybody who is off the beaten path of the authorized truth. And of course, they can all be one authorized truth. And here we are again. I can remember after 9/11, leading up to 9/11, in fact, there was a big drumbeat put out by the FBI and others that literally are all NGO groups around them, that said that the Patriot groups in the US could be the worst enemy in America. They were the biggest threat, according to the FBI. And this is before 9/11 happened. And even then, it took quite a while for it to sort of die off as well, that kind of attitude. But now they've kind of resurrected different attitudes again, with the same kind of thing behind it, of course. And they will proceed to eliminate all those who are not authorized to be out there, until you're left with the counterintelligence. And don't forget, counterintelligence will have incredible funding. It will give out sometimes more information on events and so on than anybody else. And it's got to be checkable to give credence. But then they spin you off into politics or into more wars across the world and that kind of thing, you see. That's how it's really done. A brief look at the internet and through the different video systems and so on will tell you who still hasn't been pulled and who has no problem being found if you do searches on them. It's quite amazing. Where everybody else has been simply cut off and their finances have been shackled pretty well. To get them off, out of your headspace, you might say. There's nothing unique in this. Back in the 90s, I did shows on regular media, on what they did and the big cartels who owned regular media and the history of it too. And I read from the Royal Institute for International Affairs on documentation on their control, say in Britain, for instance, as an example. And how, before World War II started, they gathered their members in, the ones who owned, they were the cartel owners of the media in Britain, and they had a meeting in an afternoon, because it wasn't even sure if Britain would even be involved in any war in Europe. But they wanted, the Royal Institute for International Affairs had its own agenda, of course, they always have their own agenda, and they needed the public support to fill the uniforms that would go off and do the fighting. They talked about ways that they could publicize and terrify, the words were terrify, the British readers of their newspapers. And they said, and so they all agreed, there and then to broadcast on radio, it would be the BBC, and with using their newspapers write-ups on the fact that Germany was going to come and gas them all, and them and their children from the air. And they also said that they would be out digging trenches against... Well, trenches aren't much use in modern air bombardments, believe you me. And they knew that, but it was to get an active... It was to get something done in the big cities that would get through to the public. You see how we're conditioned and used. If you see folks suddenly frantically digging trenches in your cities, something that hasn't happened becomes a reality to you. Oh, we're all going to get slaughtered by the, that is nasty. So it builds up anger for against people who haven't done anything to you yet. It's a precursor. It's predictive programming. You get, oh my God, they're going to bomb us. Are any gases? They even said they're going to come over and they would castrate all the able-bodied men. This is the moguls, the owners of the newspapers in London. That's what they said to do, and they did. They put it all out there to terrify the public. Well, immediately the women Hitler said in Germany, because he learned it long before him, but Hitler said that you must aim, the socialist government must aim all of their propaganda at the female psyche, the woman, because they demand protection, and they demand protection for their family, for their children, you see? And so you tell them that the government is now in charge, and the women won't question the government. They'll say immediately to the husband, "Oh, Jimmy, you do what they tell you." But they try to keep us safe, you see. So already the government's overruling the husband, who's maybe saying, "I don't really believe all the stuff that they're saying." But Hitler said, "Aim the propaganda at the woman because she wants peace and security and safety. Aim it over the head of the husband. The woman will come to us, the party, the political party." And then he said, the child will follow the woman, and therefore the man must therefore follow the child. So it's bum, 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 1, 2, 3, that's how it works. And it never changes. It doesn't matter about all of the freedoms that different genders have today or anything else. Women still are more prone to demand. And it's what socialism knows. We are your friend. We'll give you your rights. We'll give you this, we'll give you that. Etc., etc. But it's a price to pay. And the price is that the government expects you to jump and jump and jump whenever they tell you to back them up. There's always a price to pay. Power is not given out to people for free, never. Any more than the people who own the system. And then they'll say, well, we're going to use the people, but we'll give them a term called democracy. Because if you don't give them this idea of democracy, they won't work for us. They won't do anything we want them to do, you see. We'll make them think it's going to be their system, a brave new world or utopia, and through democracy they'll have rights. And then they supply you with all the speakers of the rights. And then you wonder, what on earth is this zoo we've got here, you know? And how come you're still just as poor at the bottom and getting worse? You have to understand this. You're not living in the system you've been trained to see. Bertrand Russell said that we, meaning his clique that he belonged to, a very high clique in fact, he said we used to believe that all we had to do was to point out to the public what was right and wrong and what they should and shouldn't do, and suggested them the better paths to follow. And he said how wrong we were. What we really needed to do was use what really worked, a brass band, flags and parades and things. That's what the public will follow. It's an emotional thing. This would be a time in history where so much of our own money, of course, through grants, gets used to pay for studies and programs to control our behavior on behalf of the ones who own the system, basically. And it works awfully well, incredibly well, because the amount of financing the different teams in psychology and behaviorism get is staggering, folks. But again, money's nothing to those who simply add numbers on it, to the long, long numbers already exist of what the debt is supposed to be. It's nothing at all when you just keep... one time it's just print and paper, now it's just digitalized additions that's added on to computers. It's backed by nothing. So you understand that it's interesting that the central banking system is a closed shop. You're talking about a high temple of the occult that's right there, because you and I can know darn well that at the end of the month, if your bills don't tally up and your income is less than your output, then you're in trouble. But governments have no problem with this. when you get a financial crash, it's because the elite at the top planned it that way. They want it. It doesn't have to happen. They could just divert it. They can just put it off forever if they want to. And so it's to suit what they call an adjustment for themselves, not for us. And the last, of course, the crash that we had, the 2007-08 crash, is still wide open. Every country, every country borrowed from the U.S. See, the U.S. Federal Reserve today is not just the U.S. Reserve. It's pretty well a reserve to the planet when you look at the money that's owed to them by all the other countries, including Canada. We also had bailout money the last time. And special drawing rights in Canada from the Federal Reserve. We were included in the Americans' banks as well. But we have to pay it back, naturally. And of that, they managed to really reduce the currency value, the purchasing power of the currency in Canada, by about 35, almost 40%. Well, pretty well, it's 40% now. And everything shot up in price. And the foodstuffs has gone up in price too. But that's not the end of the story, because when you look at everything that's happening, it's meant to look all disconnected. All the different events are disconnected, unconnected, but disconnected from a single cause or a single purpose or a single agenda. And here we go with conspiracy theories, which they say now is a new taboo. It's the same as the old patriots being the danger to the planet or to country or the U.S. or whatever it was at 9/11. Now, of course, it's conspiracy theorists. Conspiracy theorists. It's so interesting when you read and you recorded the petty, pathetic little inquiries, these little routine nonsense things they had after the crash of the economy that started in the US in 2007-08, and they had these little hearings, and to hear the chiefs of the Reserve and all the rest of it saying, well, the money went to money heaven, and with a sarcastic attitude, knowing and saying that the US couldn't even charge these people with anything. Greenspan said it too. He weighed in on it as well and said the US can't charge them. It's a completely different body from government. It's untouchable. Nothing they can do about it. So here we are. We lived through all this thing. Because of it, we're poorer off than ever before. It was an adjustment, as I say. It was for the elite's own reasons. But when the elite then bail out other countries, not just Canada, but in countries across Europe too, we've got special drawing rights over that. You understand that money is always a control factor. It's the control factor. And no loan is put out without it isn't just all legalese to do with paybacks. There's conditions and social conditions and cultural conditions attached to it that must be met. We saw that first when Hillary Clinton was in the US State Department. But when they were giving out different grants across the world, as always, you see, she started tacking on all these things that the people in Africa scratched in their heads. Because now it's overt, we're not going to give you your loan unless you promote this law and promote that law and et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, that interfered with their culture. Well, now all the countries are the same, you see, we're all getting hit with the same things. That's what you do with the system. This money is a control factor. Every government on the planet has to go cap in hand to the central banking system every year to borrow more of these nothings that are then tacked onto their computers as, okay, they put money in. It's a big club at the top, really. It's a rich, rich, rich club. Because how can you not be rich when you're at the top creating money out of nothing? And the whole planet just accepts it. I mean, what a heady experience that must be, eh? We're trained to see the world in a certain way, and it really is different. The reason being, you've all forgotten that when the agenda for the 21st century, that used to also be called the Millennium Project, was all signed with the sustainability agreements and all the rest of it, and now you have different parts of it split up into about 15-year periods for further negotiation to ramp the next level through, the next level, the next level through. But don't forget, the original one is for the whole century. It's telling you what they have to accomplish in stages for the whole century. And population control is in there. Eventually, housing in Agenda 21, there'll be no private ownership of property. Did I know if you read it? You see, what you're going to have is what's coming up right now. And you've been led into it. No private property. So let's look at this little article. This is start here, right? Now, this one here is for Canada, but it could be anywhere. It could be Australia, New Zealand, London, or anywhere in the world, actually, because you'll see the same articles across every country. Priced out of the market, three housing alternatives for hot markets. This is with a sluggish economy, so they're admitting it's sluggish, right? What do you mean it's sluggish? We don't produce material things anymore. And tight lending rules. So the big central bankers are tightening the lending rules. Being priced out of the real estate market is a reality for many, particularly those in Toronto and Vancouver. But where your finances are limited or you simply don't want to overextend yourself, there are other options. This is like Toronto, for instance. It says, where recent statistics show the median family income. Now, these are always approximate things. And don't forget, you have a tiny minority that's earning hundreds and hundreds of times more per family than other average families. So you can't get a really good figure for average at all, really. But anyway, it says the median family income, this is family income, is $75,270 per annum, right? And the average home cost, $762,975. So using these figures, prospective homeowners wouldn't be able to qualify for a mortgage. The maximum purchase price this medium family's income could support is $620,935. And they need to put 6% down. But affordability starts to come into the picture, but an hour west of the city. So in other words, they're trying to tell folk to move out, right? But if they move out, and if they're working in the city, well, now you're going to have congestion on the roads, more so, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, right? But they're trying to tell you that if you move out, then the cost of the average home is $507,131. And so that the same family with $75,270 per annum could qualify with a minimum down payment of $25,713. That's all well and good, as long as you're pretty well guaranteed to keep a job, which very few folk are today. If the businesses that are in too, they'll go bust, they'll be taken over or put out of the market. Everything's getting taken over these days, as you know. Another one, as middle class gets priced out of housing markets, Canada takes drastic steps to make it affordable. Now here's what they're doing here, right? And this is how it sounds great, because we get great announcements in Canada, and they don't need to go very far actually. It says Canada's offering free land, right? And tax incentives to create more affordably priced options in Vancouver and Toronto. I'll tell you where it's going here. Fueled by a booming tech industry. Booming, see? Now, tech industry is up and down like a yo-yo because there's so many countries involved in the same tech industry. Anyway, Toronto's economy has produced an all-too-familiar problem, soaring house prices beyond the reach of the middle class. It's also mass migration from and they've admitted it, from wealthy China. And every country says China and India. And India's got a massive middle class, too. You forget that. They're wealthy. And they can come in and buy them, the houses, right off the bat. They're like, whole. Don't bother with a mortgage. You don't need to. And China is doing the same thing too. When you look at the world prices of housing, and there are sort of lists of them, they admit it's mainly China and then India, followed by India. It has the money, very rich people moving out and is buying places. So the folk at home can't afford it. Anyway, back to this article. They complain about Vancouver and Toronto being there as if that's only places in Canada. Of course they're not, but that's all they seem to talk about these days. Canada's embarking on an ambitious plan to create more, and here's the key, moderately priced rental units. So here's everything. Well, that's great that people are going to get fuel land and moderately priced rental units. So big international landlords, they have chains of them, if you don't know that, are snapping up this kind of offer, obviously, you see. And I've done research into a lot of these organizations. And when you start, it's a light coming on, right? If your memory lasts just about 5 minutes or a bit longer, you remember, right? So here's governments using your tax money to hand out land for building and tax incentives to companies that will put up rental apartments. You see, to start, the project to cost at least $10 billion. Well, you can probably put that up to about $40, $50 billion by the time they've tied it all up. That's always the way it works. It's at a scale never before seen in Canada, both in its size and speed, and it's raising questions about where or not the country will be able to address its affordability problem before it's too late. They talk about the UBS's Group AG's annual list, major cities, etc., etc., etc. And what they're doing too, don't forget, you know, they're giving them to big projects that own rental units across the planet. But anyway, it says Westpac Projects Corporation, who spearheaded the project and recruited Allied Properties Real Estate Investments Trust to help them, is in on this act as well. And the Canadian Plan, right, run by a new non-profit. So here you go, this public-private partnership. The public pays for everything, and the private ones own it eventually. So it's a non-profit called Creative Housing Society. It proposes to build units aimed at people with medium annual incomes between 40,000 to 100,000 who spend less than 30% of their household income before tax on housing costs. Well, you see, the idea is to get you in to rental only, because again, Agenda 21, by the end of the century, they don't want people owning, at least the ordinary folk owning their own property. And you have public-private partnerships. This is what it's about. There's so many of them. It's just staggering how many international real estate agencies there are. And then these international real estate agencies are often in league or part of or a subsidiary of a bigger company of international landlord associations that have rentals throughout cities across the planet, for instance. And that's the way of the future. And the public's tax money will pay for the upkeep of these buildings and homes. And they'll be so-called thermal-friendly and eco-friendly and sustainable, etc., 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 all the fancy words that add more bucks to it. And it'll be owned in an oddball sense by these corporations. And somehow they'll word it as not really private, although of course it is. That's the way of the future. But there's quite a few articles on the same kind of thing, priced out of the housing market, yada, yada, yada. Again, still blame laundering schemes spiked by British Columbia, home cost, etc. $7.4 billion money laundering scheme. This has cost 5% report fines. The headlines never become more. I don't know if they go to school anymore. Headlines often just don't make any sense these days, do they, really? And there's so many mistakes in it too. But anyway, it says, this is actually from Vancouver, and organized criminals found British Columbia an increasingly attractive place to stash their money, largely without legal consequences. Two scathing final reports money laundering said Thursday on money laundering. Well, you see, that's where they sink their money, is to big projects, big buildings in big cities across the world, you see. I've done some of the stories a few weeks ago, or last week, or the week before, as well, on China laundering money into buildings. This is the way you get money out and to appear to be clean. Another article too says, when you buy a home in the UK, you need to earn £54,000 on average. And again, it's the same thing, same tactic you find, where it says Zoopla finds London buyers must be paid £84,000 to qualify to get a mortgage, while Liverpool requires £26,000. See how they can encourage you all to move? They don't know what they're doing, eh? When you see the same articles and for different countries, all the same articles basically, then there's something, there's a connection here, there's a reason. You also have affordability and sustainability being married, they call it. And neighbourhood organisations work with these organisations, developers, etc., contractors, architects, they all meet together. And they address the 7 LBC principles of sustainability as part of their building projects, etc. Just outside Minneapolis, it's called The Rose, incorporates pioneering green building techniques amongst 90 mixed income. That's 47 affordable and 43 market rate apartments. And so you see, everything's being changed into a brave new world, isn't it? And we're going along with it, because what choice do we have? The people don't know what else to do, except go along with it. See, you don't have what you think of as your country, whatever country you're in. You're still thinking it's your country, even though all the signs of what's happening show you the opposite. It's not your country. And the politicians you bring in, they completely ignore your problems, your real problems. And big things happen, and you don't have a clue what's happening. As I said before, the NAFTA agreement, North American Free Trade Agreement, that was drafted up, was really to amalgamate the Americas and the Caribbean and other ones too, and to bring us all under one big system, even with a central parliament down the road, if possible. They said they wouldn't need that, but they'd like to have one. But you can still run the countries without that. And if you wonder why, you haven't seen any official documentation from your governments telling you they're dissolving the borders, for instance. But you can see it and read it all the time, that's obviously been happening for quite a few years. Then obviously your government is not in charge of what's happening. Something above them is, because if your government was real and something was happening outside their control, they would make sure they took over control to get it back to where it's supposed to be under law. But they're not attending, which means they're told to hands off these new normals. Now I'll show you a little example of people who think that they're up at the top, or near the top at least. And you can see the arrogance of the strutters. They verbally strut, and their attitude is superior, of superiority, etc. Because they're spoiled. They're spoiled. But they think they're in charge of much of what's going on, because they've helped to shape the opinions across the planet through electronic programming, through different systems. Now, here's an example. It's just an example of one person that I think was on television discussing what happened to him in 2017. And you wonder if he really gets it yet, and during that discussion at least. But it's on Shamath Palihapitiya, his name is. He's a venture capitalist, right? He has the big money again. And the founder of and CEO of Social Capital. He was born in Sri Lanka. And at 6 years old, moved his family to Canada. Went to school and college and all the rest of it until he did really well in electronics. And then he went down to the States, worked for a year as a derivative trader. Again, derivatives and all the rest of it is to me, I can't tell the difference between hedge funds and derivatives, unless maybe the derivatives are the leads that are left after you've cut the hedge. But it says here that it's a trade investment bank, BMO, at Nesbitt Burns. And he moved to California to be with his then girlfriend, Bridget Lowe, and then they married and so on. He joined AOL, becoming the youngest vice president of the company in its history, heading its instant messaging division in 2004. 2005, he left and joined Mayfield Fund. A few months later, left that job and joined Facebook. And this is the key to it, which was then a little more than a year old. So he was one of the, maybe the partial, one of the many, maybe partial kind of founders in a sense. This is Palihapitiya's work. Facebook involved trying to increase its user base. It says that when he joined it, he had contempt for people who merely write code, because he has that attitude around him, and contempt. But that his experience at Facebook led him to revise his beliefs. He was there for 4 or 5 years before he revised it. So one of the things he admired about Mark Zuckerberg, he says, it was his lack of ego. Well, I don't know where he got that from. An ability to make business decisions dispassionately. I hope you understand that these business decisions are much bigger than giving you something to chat with across the planet. It's a whole new culture. And there's a YouTube, I'll put up a link to it, where this man talks about it. And he talks about when he left Facebook, because the incredible power it had and how it could cause tremendous harm as well, etc. But he says that, like, the power to influence people's behavior and so on, right? And culture. So he's left it, and he now is supposedly, he's advising people to do the same as him, and all get together, all the biggies, basically, and create a good, proper culture for the people, creating new morals by using all these algorithms and behavioral modification techniques they can use. They don't even know they're getting used on you. Well, hold on a second here. Isn't that simply a continuation of the Facebook with a different company? And did anybody ask the population anywhere on the planet, do you want your culture changed? And if y'all said even yeah, were you asked about what you would want for a culture? No. The arrogance of the people involved in the tech industry who admits the power that they have to change, and they use it all the time to change and create the culture that's rapidly disintegrating. He admits that, by the way. But I think it's disintegrating because it was intended to be that way. But let's be honest here. Who's given them the power to and the right to interfere with your mindset in such a way that you have no say-so in it? You don't even know that it's been done to you, because it's so perfectly done. It's a tremendous cycle of operation going on all the time. They admit this in lots of their writings, by the way, folks. So this guy now, where it's his own idea, or he's been used, is being used as a form of revolutionary for political lobbying strategies and so on. But his answer is basically to use it to properly, with all their power that they have, to create a good culture. Well, whose opinion is it? Clarify what he means by a good culture. And let's be honest here. How does this tie in with democracy? It doesn't, does it? Doesn't. When you're not asked, or do you mind if we alter your behavior? Or do you mind if we penalize you for your opinions? Or even your thoughts? Even the thought's only a question. The borders on a taboo subject, no matter what it happens to be. Who gives them the right to say they're going to punish you for that? Because that's where it's all gone. I hope you understand. So anyway, this fella got some media attention when he came, at least talked about it, and how they know they got these dopamine-driven feedback loops, they call them, and Facebook deliberately designed into them to make it addictive and to really get to the young folk and then give them their opinions and so on. That everything out there is so weaponized. You can't watch anything on television without being brainwashed. There's even a talk that Star Trek was loaded with all these messages, or make you think, maybe you should think about this particular problem that way or this way, until it becomes your opinion too. Everything out there. See, the entertainment value is the hook to get you to watch, and the rest of it is really just weaponized payloads that get into your brain. That's what it's for. So I'll put these articles up along with another one too with Facebook. Facebook could soon be snooping on your encrypted WhatsApp messages under plans to moderate content on the platform. So once again, it's also a censorship of speech. Moderate content, right? They're using online artificial intelligence algorithms to scan and moderate content in its WhatsApp messaging service to enforce its acceptable speech policy. There you go. By the way, this young fella who wants to give you a new culture, or basically new morality, on the talk he cusses and swears. This is your new guru to give you your good culture and good values and so on. And where do you get all this cussing and swearing from? I never heard so many folk cussing and swearing. It's all from everything on your social media and on your movies and everything else. That's what started it all. I think Britain was the first target of that, big time, actually. Also put up, remember, the world's largest real estate companies in 2018. That's quite a good list that ties in with the housing I mentioned earlier there. This article, should the rich be allowed to buy the best genes? And so biology is a new tech, and there's a conference at Quebec City on CRISPR technology, the molecular tool designed to edit genes. It goes through some of it and some of the, again, your new gods up there, the white-coated gods that found ways to edit the genes and so on, and alter the genetic coding, and how wonderful it all is. We should worship them all, you know. We should, yes. At one time, as I've said like last week, but the people who go off to work at big agency labs to create biowarfare, to slaughter millions of people, and they have families, and they tend their gardens, and they have wives and stuff, and vice versa. Wives have husbands, and they might go off and do the creation of biowarfare technologies. Well, it's the same with this stuff here too. Because now you're truly God when you can come in and decide what kind of creature you want to be. But don't forget Brave New World, Aldous Huxley, 1932, I think it was, or 33 came out with. That's where you're going with it all. It's all eugenics, always eugenics. And another article I wanted to put on too, stop ale herbicide spraying on the Sudbury Forest. Near me, they've been spraying over the Sudbury Forest, and there were articles in 2015 about it. They wanted Monsanto's product glyphosate stopped, and Garland XRT-PCP, systemic herbicide containing triclopyr, which is will also be used, it said here. I've got two articles on it, and I'd like to just put it up because it's important. Why are they doing this, eh? Well, I mean, again, I know we're disposable when you get way outside the big important cities. Remember the super cities that the UN declared back 10 to 12 years ago, and how these would be the big places of the future. They'd be countries, in a sense. Everything outside of them would just die off because you wouldn't be living in them anymore. You'd be off the land, Agenda 21, living in these big cities. I guess that's what they're doing here. They're definitely spraying a lot of stuff on us that shouldn't be there at all. This other article, too, is to do with more spraying on Sudbury. They call it Rain of Death on Canada's forests. It isn't just at Sudbury. But Global Research has got an article there too, just for those who want to know about it. Anyway, where are we here now? Because I'm running out of time. I'm trying to keep it shorter talks because other folk put them up, and there's one that was up on a radio thing, actual radio broadcast eventually, and it tends to go over. So, former Google engineer says Google will try to prevent Trump's re-election. Well, it tells you that if Google is surviving and has been allowed to do what it does, which is total control and total data collection, it's working for the people who own the planet. How's that? Obviously. So there's no government stepped in to lessen its powers at all. They give these little, oh, we're talking, we're looking at this, we're looking at that. No, forget that rubbish. It was set up by the intelligence agency of the planet, of those who rule it, the planet, basically, that's what I'd say. Also, they've got first human monkey chimera. We've talked about this years ago. It raises concern among scientists. Why not concern about the public? So they've actually done it naturally. I'm sure it's not the first time either. So anyway, they've produced monkey embryos containing human cells. A chimera, by definition, it says is an organism whose cells come from two or more individuals. That was done at the Salk Institute. People who worked at the Salk Institute in the States. And the stretch was, they did research in China, it says. So they took their research over to China because it would avoid legal issues back in the States. But it's the professors Juan Carlos Espizua and Belmont from the Salk Institute in the US are the ones who did this particular thing. You know where it's all going, eh? And they will make certain types of efficient workers for different functions and so on. We probably won't even blink an eye when that all happens because we're so conditioned into the inevitability of it. This whole thing about Mr. Epstein, Jeffrey Epstein, I personally am pretty certain, from what I've never read, that definitely it's to me, it's an intelligence operation, obviously. And I think even the first investigations they had on him years ago, they've admitted that the man was, the guy was put in charge of it, I think it was a Conti, was told to kind of back off to an extent because this guy belongs to intelligence, that came out. And of course, they're not saying which intelligence agency, and it probably be more than one. I'm sure the US all use it as well, because you don't do such incredible honey trap systems without exploiting it to the best you can to get all important people who help run affairs of over the population. Yeah, you get them all, as many as possible, and get the blackmailable stuff on them, and everybody involved in these things who actually succumbs to it and goes along into the honey trap. It's understood. They're not stupid that they now owe a favor, a big favor, to the person who set it up for them, and they also know that they are blackmailable. Obviously, it's set different countries scampering for excuses on what to tell the public. Well, right off the bat, outcome, oh, well, you see, he's just an oddball character. So he take it down instead of it being a certain country, any country's intelligence agency, let's take it down to him being an oddball, screwy character, right, that just wanted to repopulate the world with his own seed. That's how to get off track. But the fact is, no, this was a big operation, heavily used to influence people in all parties in the States and in Britain, other countries too. And there's royalty involved, as you know, as well. And that's a big, powerful organization. So they can't let that go to waste, and information will not be released to the public of it all. No way at all will they do that. But they'll use it. And I think what's going to... And I tell you, it's sort of well-timed. I mentioned it years ago when all the countries in the West, and we had their censorship departments for culture. Used to have that for television programming and movies and stuff. And they met years ago talking about they'd won the battle. Because these organizations were not there to safeguard the public. The public thought they were. They were there to see if they're ready to push the envelope even further. And they discussed what the steps would be for the next step. They did mention about intergenerational sex would be the next step that they would promote on television, put into movies and drama series, etc. And I'm certain that this is going to give, if it gets into any court systems, you're going to hear the top behaviorists and psychologists brought out to explain to the public, well, you know, it's changed now. There's no child is ignorant of sexuality anymore from the age of 5 on. I guarantee this is going to come out. And they'll say, yeah, and some children are precocious, and some are even sexually involved very early at 11 and 12. They get these oddball cases, but they will find them. And then they'll come up with many other ones too about the children's, the information they've gleaned from the children's social habits and social networks, where they boast about this. And they'll say, well, see, how can you possibly say that this man, he wasn't jumping out of a car, grabbing them and raping them, see? It was a contract, financial. And these children knew what they were doing. That's what's going to come out of this. And out of it will come that the reduction of the age limit for sexual contact for children. And they may even introduce legislation to be okay. I'm not kidding you, because they talked about this many years ago. I've followed this stuff for years and years and years. It's part of the real cultural warfare on society. And where they mentioned that eventually there would be no restrictions between intergenerational sexual contact. You wait and see. You just wait and see. and they'll give you sights. And people would, well, yeah, they knew what they were doing. And no, 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 they couldn't at that age. How, who could blow? And they'll go, and they get the public arguing amongst themselves. Eh? Just too easy, isn't it? Too easy. And here's the sad thing. You see, there's a term they use, and it was used by the communists, that Crystal West used it as well. When you were enamored by an enemy's country, by the system that they had, you might have liked parts of it. It was, you're called contaminated. Because now you start liking that's not too bad. It's a good culture. And so they might lose you. And so bad, in fact, that Stalin killed many, many, many Russians and imprisoned them in the gulags when they were released at the end of World War II. Because they had been involved, they now had been in contact outside the communist Soviet bloc countries, then met other people as prisoners. But even that could be enough to contaminate them. And so they couldn't be trusted. The parents today, starting with, say the parents were even in the 1960s, and then if they had children, so they're 20 years old, in their 20s, they'd have children, and then those children would grow up, and they'd been in their 20s, in the 80s, all the way down to the present time, step by step by step. You could now have your great-grandmother sitting with your granny and your mother and then the children, all in a row. And the dad's there too, if you can find them. And they could be watching 50 Shades of Grey or whatever else they're watching today with S&M and bestiality or pornography. How can you get through to people what's happening when they watch stuff like this for entertainment? And that will come out too during these trials. Do you understand what I'm saying? I'm not standing up for this. I'm telling you how it's supposed to go. We've been in a war for an awful long time. The complete destruction of Western civilization and the family unit. And it hasn't stopped. But now you can't get parents today because, again, we've all had our dose of contamination. No one escaped it. And the parents will, oh, well, you know. And they probably, after the debates go on television, get played on television by faces that they like, you know, talk show people on television, they'll say, oh, well, you know, maybe they're right, you know. Maybe the, what's wrong with lowering the age, you know. they will guarantee. When you can get folk to put holes through their faces, to hang objects on, and to tattoo themselves, through social media, through entertainment, through the massive algorithms and brainwashing they get, thinking they're going to be individualistic. Well, you can't be individualistic when you've got a whole bunch of folk to compete with doing the same stuff. Then there's nothing that they can't do with you. I hope you understand that. Now, back to Epstein too. There's two articles, awfully important as well, because it ties in with what happened recently where Boris Johnson just magically was basically put in there as the Prime Minister to take over from May, and he appointed his cabinet. And I had a laugh when he appointed them, because people really, they're clutching at straws, hoping to regain some past something of a whole culture and society. Even the working classes too. That's all gone. All the industry's gone. There's nothing to hold on to, but they want it. So anybody promising them some kind of vague promise, I feel we're like the American Indians. After all the Indian wars, as they called them, against Indians. And they came up with the ghost dance in the late 1800s, where you put a big pole in the ground and basically ropes coming from it with hooks on the ends. And they would put these hooks through themselves and swirl around in the sun without eating, you know, so that the heat and starvation and the suffering, and trying to get visions of hope, religious experience of hope. And someone had put the word out that if they kept doing it, if enough of them did all this, you do it with desperation. This is suffering. This is the extreme of suffering. This is what drives you to when you see your everything you knew that was yours and your ancestors, right up to your recent ancestors and your parents, all they knew was getting wiped out, destroyed. And they hoped that even the ghosts, like the idea that you saw and Lord of the Rings idea with the shades or what they call them, but they hope the ghosts of all the old warriors going down through the ages would come back and drive the white man off the land to regain the lifestyle they used to have of hunting. A simple lifestyle, but they all had work to do. The guys would hunt and so on. And the women, and no, they weren't all peaceful. These Indians fought each other like all tribes do. And but they all had, but they seemed to have function. It was taken away, then you become self-destructive. And they certainly were not getting, before they were given booze, alcohol. They weren't drinking themselves to death. They didn't have glues to sniff themselves to death. They didn't get drugs flooded into them to kill themselves off. But that's the technique that's now been used on what's left of the Western world, folks. The articles on drug abuse, it's not lessening, it's getting worse and worse and worse and worse. But getting back to Britain here, and the folk in Britain are hoping this group will pull them out of something, these appointees. But Priti Patel, that was put over, as she's the head of the Home Office. Eh? Whoa. That's the job, I think, that Theresa May had before. And then you got MI5 and MI6 under there and all that kind of stuff. Priti Patel, is it all forgotten of her secret meetings? The Guardian did articles on them in Britain. I'll put links up for the ones that care. But her job was to give British aid out, meaning our taxpayer money, people's taxpayer money, dish out across the world to the poor folks so they could eat and so on, and have education. But she was in her own time. Under the law, they're supposed to have their cabinet around them wherever they go to meet foreign dignitaries. Well, she thought, well, she'd go her own way, and she was going over to Israel about 12 or 13, maybe 14 times, didn't announce to her department. Supposedly, this is what we're told. They were talking about possibly give aid to Israel, right? And now she supposedly, it's in an article here, it reported a visit to an Israeli field hospital in the occupied Golan Heights. Here's the key to it, which could have taken place only with both Israeli military and political clearance. If you remember back then, Israel had set up hospitals, and they say here in these articles, to treat Syrian fighters. Well, what it was ISIS groups, it was the mercenaries that were trying to kick Assad out. And because I got the articles here at the time, when it was all happening, and the wounded were getting taken back, and Israel was treating them to send them back to fight again, you see, to try to overthrow Syria. Which tells you, and yes, okay, Priti Patel, amongst many others, she was the head of the British Conservative Party's Friends of Israel Association, sure, but most of them are, in all parties. But it tells me that she's intelligence. Now you all debate which the intelligence service is, but the fact is, when she wasn't even kicked out of governmental positions, she was simply put on a different position out of the limelight. But here she's been basically given the top job in Britain, eh? It tells you that she was unoperative back then because Britain was... This is how you get around and get money to an operation that you want. Because Britain and the US, we had the articles spelled out in great detail, no conspiracy involved at the time, from the same newspapers across the world, of what was happening there, and that we were funding these fighters, these ISIS, and ICE fighters, and ISIL, and all the rest of the names they gave it. Same thing. And given the weaponry, weapons too. So we wanted it. I hate this word, we. This whole thing of saying you're from this country or that, you forget that, because I don't know anybody in Britain that voted for war. They weren't given a vote in the first place, or even asked their opinion on any of these wars. We've got to get out of this habit of blaming nations. London has always wanted Syria to be under a new regime, as they call it. And of course they're funding it too. I can remember reading Spy Catchers by Peter Wright. And Peter Wright, he said that to get money at one point, MI5 had a lot of fake organisations down that were going to get money from, you see. And so they had different organisations that were labelled, some of them were labelled as lesbian NGOs, but they didn't exist. And that money that was put to these NGOs was actually coming into MI5's coffers for different projects. And this is the kind of way they do it. So Patel, obviously, was over there, and that's why she wasn't really punished for it at all. She's still working for probably MI6, I would say, at least. And maybe another country too, who knows? Maybe a few. Personally, I think that all the top organisations are all one. That's my opinion. You couldn't keep folk out of them. You couldn't stop infiltrators. So they have to be one. So anyway, I thought I'd just toss that in there too for those who want to have a look at it. And there's no time relief for anything else. I've got stacks of articles, but time has run out again. And as I say, I can't really go over too much of a time limit. Now remember, you can help me tick along and keep going by donating to cuttingthroughthematrix.com website. There you'll find out how to send money. And you can also list all the other sites I have listed on the cuttingthroughthematrix.com website, which are mine. These are my official sites. Anything outside of that isn't mine. So remember, order your books and discs at cuttingthroughthematrix.com or one of the sites listed on that particular site. So for myself, Alan Watt from Ontario, Canada, where I'm getting sprayed by